From the University of Wisconsin-Madison, welcome to the Surgery Set. I'm your host, Jonathan Kohler. I'm an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here, and I am exploring the ideas and innovations of our department and all the speakers who come to visit us here in Madison. Our guest today is Dr. Sarah Holden. She's a general surgery resident actually here at the University of Wisconsin, one of our chief residents. She graduated from the University of Minnesota Medical School in 2010 and then came to Madison shortly thereafter and is soon to head out again to Washington University in St. Louis for a MIS fellowship. While she was here, she served 2 years as a postdoctorate research fellow in Dr. Herbert Chen's lab, working on surgical oncology research, and her research interests include clinical outcomes after parathyroid and thyroid surgery, as well as clinical characteristics and post-resection surveillance of gastrointestinal carcinoid tumors, which is not what she talked about with us today. But she gave an amazing grand rounds that will be available online on the website, and we're going to use that as a stepping off point for our conversation today. But the key thing I think we need to first delve right into is that you spent 2 months on the pediatric surgery service, Dr. Holden, and never once mentioned that you were featured in ESPN magazine.
That is something I keep under the radar, for sure.
Yeah, All-American soccer team, which obviously would have meant nothing to me, but pretty incredible athletic history coming into the surgery residency.
Right.
How has that served you?
Oh, I think there's a lot of similarities between athletics and surgical training, just in terms of fatigue and the work that you put in to become a better skilled practitioner or soccer player. I think the same effort that you put into both really leads you to a great outcome. And so I see a lot of similarities between the two.
And we've recently put our editor, Alex Worley, on the task of finding out about our podcast speakers, and he's done a little bit of research and discovered that you were also an AmeriCorps Community Corps volunteer?
I was, yeah. So I actually joined the AmeriCorps National Civilian Community Corps, which is sort of similar to Peace Corps, but it's based here in America. And I joined in 2005, and right after I joined, and I was initially supposed to be based in California, but right after I joined, Hurricane Katrina hit. And so the entire Corps was transferred from wherever they were down to Louisiana and Alabama to help with the relief effort in the Gulf Coast.
So you were an undergrad at that point?
I had just finished undergrad. Yep. So I took a year off before medical school to do AmeriCorps.
So what was that like? Like what were you doing?
So we lived in these big tent cities, and we kind of slept on the floor, on the dirt ground. And we worked with FEMA Corps of Engineers and Habitat for Humanity and other local kind of nonprofit agencies that were down there helping with the relief effort.
So you lived in, basically in New Orleans?
Yeah, I lived in New Orleans, and we moved to Baton Rouge, and then I lived in Biloxi as well.
And you were there for a year
mm-hmm.
on the relief.
Correct.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was an experience you will never forget, for sure.
Did you know you were going to medicine at that point?
I did know that I wanted to go to medical school, but I knew that I wanted to take a year off as a break from the academic world just to really experience what else there was out there. And to, you know, growing up in, you know, a well-to-do suburb in Minneapolis, I felt so lucky to have that background and that upbringing. But I really wanted to be able to kind of stretch my wings a little bit and see what else was out there and how I could help.
Wow. One of my colleagues, Peter Nickel, who's another pediatric surgeon here, calls you Golden Holden. I now get it a little bit better. Let's talk a little bit about your talk, which was really fascinating. I feel like hits at some themes that seem to sort of be percolating up in medical discussion and sort of like the community discussion. I recently read this book, The Undoing Project, by Michael Lewis. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of it?
I haven't, no.
It talks a lot about Daniel Kahneman, who you talk about in your talk, and his partner, and the way that they came up with this idea of heuristics and the way, basically an understanding of the way that we think and the way that we make errors.
Right.
And that has struck me as sort of like, I'm seeing it everywhere now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you just hit it right on the head with this discussion that you gave basically about why we make errors and how we think and ways that we can think and maybe make fewer mistakes or at least sort of be less prone to these biases that you talk about and you sort of list out for us in the talk. You talk a lot about sort of there are two ways of thinking. And maybe can you just sort of give give us a little rundown of what you call System 1 and System 2.
Yeah, so I really got this from Daniel Kahneman, who, you know, like I said, was one of the fathers of behavioral economics. And he really examines how we make decisions under uncertainty. And, you know, he was sort of focused on the economics aspect, but it really is transferable to any decision that we make. System 1 and System 2 are two modes of thinking. System 1 being kind of your fast, your intuitive, your gut instinct. And then System 2 is the slower thinking or the deep thinking, the chance to slow things down and really evaluate your initial intuition that was given from System 1.
Yeah. And you talk about how as we become more expert, or the process of becoming more expert is about to refining both of those systems.
Exactly. Right? Yep. So it's about expanding your System 1 intuition by having years of clinical experience so that you can generate an automatic skilled response from System 1. But it's also about when to know that you can trust that System 1 response. And that's where System 2 comes in, knowing when your System 2 needs to be more aware or when it needs to fine-tune your System 1 intuition.
And the problem being that we are prone to some very serious biases in the way that we analyze information.
Right. Right. And, you know, I only went through about four of them today. There was hundreds, literally there's hundreds of cognitive biases that I could have spoken to. But I think the, you know, the anchoring bias, hindsight bias, confirmation bias, and then the availability error are ones that are so prevalent in medicine and really lead to so many cognitive errors unless we're careful.
And I would argue even that there's like a, there's a System 3 in my mind. Now here I am inventing psychology, right? But System 3, I mean, I think, so I'm a new attending, right? And like I went through residency and I was sort of interested in the same concept, sort of like ways that we can get fooled, you know, because there were definitely cases in my residency where, you know, we were sure it was something and then it wasn't that thing. Something bad happened. We went back. There was some obvious, in retrospect, sign that we'd missed.
Right.
I hadn't put names on them, but I think I'd sort of thought about System 1 and 2. And I also think that residents have the System 3, which is the attending, right? So like you have your System 1, like you're intuitively thinking like, okay, it's this thing. And then your System 2 kicks in and you're like, oh, yeah, now I'm going to sort of overthink this and go and dig into it a little further and think critically about this and look up, you know, publish research on it. And then I'm going to ask somebody else.
Right.
And they're going to tell me what it is and kind of whatever they say is right. And I, as an attending, like you lose that, right? You no longer have that higher authority. You can go ask your partners, whatever, but it's kind of ultimately you. And I think that to me has exposed System 1 and System 2 more dramatically because you can no longer sort of say, there's no longer going to be like an ultimate arbiter of truth.
Exactly.
I feel like I've sort of started detecting those biases more in myself. Mm-hmm. A big one you talk about is availability error. I see that like all the time.
All the time. Yeah. I mean, we do it all the time, and whether it's conscious or unconscious. You know, when I was forming this talk and reading more and more about these cognitive biases, I could literally just remember decisions that I had made where I had used an availability bias or a hindsight bias. And by just learning about them and realizing that they're there, I think, you know, since prepping this talk, I've already kind of expanded these decisions and these cognitive biases to my own clinical decisions. And so that was the goal of my talk today, was to just present these, make people aware of them so that they could at least be aware of them in their own clinical scenarios.
Yeah, because we know that it's a huge problem.
Right.
I mean, one example you give is that if you ask, you know, 100 people if they are an above average driver, 80 of them say yes. Mm-hmm. But in clinical medicine, I mean, there are good examples of this being a problem, right?
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, overconfidence is just rampant in medicine. It's how we deal with uncertainty a lot of times. And I, you know, I almost gave my whole talk on uncertainty in medicine and how we deal with that, but I was only able to get into it slightly. But I find that very interesting, how we become as clinicians okay with being uncertain about a clinical problem.
Yeah. And that real true expert knowledge involves sort of being okay with that uncertainty as opposed to sort of earlier, maybe like you try to banish uncertainty, you try to always be certain, you know, that sort of sometimes wrong,
right?
Never in doubt, right?
Right.
And then, you know, I think that's true of the really expert clinicians I know is that they're willing to say, like, I don't know what's going on.
Right. I don't know if it's A or B.
So we need to figure it out, or we need to, like, make a probability-based assessment on, like, which way to go, and then be critical about what happens after the fact.
Exactly.
And not assume, not try to make the facts fit what direction we're going.
Exactly right.
You talk about expert intuition, which is sort of like this advanced heuristic. It's like turning your system one sort of gut instinct into something that's much more refined.
Right.
Reminded me a lot of a professor of mine in medical school who talked a lot about the still small voice, this like little voice you hear in the back of your head being like, I don't know.
Not right.
Yeah. Right.
And that's a very important feeling to be okay with and to really expose in yourself, because if something isn't fitting, that's our system too saying, whoa, something's not right. We need to slow down and really take a closer look at this. And so we need to teach medical students and teach trainees to really embrace that feeling as opposed to push it aside.
Mm-hmm. And you sort of outline like three key steps to developing that expert intuition. I mean, if only it was as simple as that. But
right.
The first was regularity and consistency.
Mm-hmm. So I use the example of every biliary colic patient needs to look like biliary colic, or at least somewhat similar, to help us kind of put these patterns into our mind and solidify what a normal biliary colic patient looks like.
Right. And then the next was prolonged practice. Mm-hmm. See lots and lots and lots of biliary colic patients.
That's right? Why surgical craniotomy is 5 years long. We need that repetition.
Right. And that's the work hours argument, right?
Exactly.
Like, be in the hospital, just see it.
Right.
A simulator is never going to give it to you the same way. So you're going to be able to learn how to just like smell something when you go into the room, like literally or figuratively.
Right.
And then the third, which I think is really key and probably the hardest one, right, is feedback and outcomes of your decisions.
Right. And I think that's where, in surgery, we're lucky in that we have immediate feedback on a lot of our decisions, whether we can tell on exam, to the image, to the patient that we, operative findings, we have the opportunity as surgeons to be able to follow that whole course. Whereas in radiology or some of the other more non-procedural fields, we don't necessarily get that immediate feedback, or we don't know, for example, if the image that we read is, acute cholecystitis was in fact acute cholecystitis. We don't actually know that because we don't see the operative findings. And so I think that for a surgeon, that's very helpful. And it's a matter of experiencing that and then really putting that into our memory about the course of action and how you came to that decision.
Yeah. And just systematically doing that. I mean, one of the people who were sort of responded to your talk, and there were a lot of great questions, and I actually haven't seen our audience this engaged after the fact discussion in a long time.
My hope.
Yeah. But someone made the point, like, keep a list of your patients mm-hmm. who have weird presentations or who fool you and follow them.
Right. And I think this is something that, the HIPAA violations are really hard for trainees because technically we're not supposed to follow patients if we're not actively involved in their clinical care that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you go off service, you're technically not supposed to follow them, but I find that to be really horrible. I mean, from an education standpoint, we need to be able to follow these patients and figure out what the endpoint was or what the process was that led them to their endpoint. I find that to be a very difficult line to walk.
Yeah, I mean, it is so hard. Like, it seems as though the world sort of throws up roadblocks.
Right.
To
appropriate education.
Appropriate education and to appropriate practice of medicine. I mean, like, everybody can list 1,000 things that make it hard. But I think your talk did an amazing job of sort of illustrating and putting names and labels on some of these things that challenge the way that we think and the way that we interpret information. And, like all things, I think once you know that it exists and sort of acknowledge its existence of these biases and these ways of thinking abnormally, that's a huge step in the right direction.
Exactly. And I think making people aware of this sooner in their medical training is better. The earlier that we can introduce this thought process that we have two systems and we're kind of fighting each other and working together, and it's really to become an expert clinician is how we manage those two systems of thought. And of course, plus the years of experience that you need to have your expert intuition.
Yeah. And you mentioned a number of resources and publications in your talk. We'll link them on the webpage for the podcast. So if people are interested, then go and find the books you're talking about.
There's a lot of great books on this subject. Yep.
Awesome. Before we wrap up, I just need to point out to our listeners that you have gone through residency and done a stellar job and are off to like an amazing new career. And you also, in the process of residency, like during clinical years, had two children.
Yeah.
And I have one child and I have a much easier job and I am barely functioning.
I feel like I'm barely functioning all the time. Well, you know, the thing is, in surgical training, there's no great time to have a child, and they're all bad times if you think about it. So, you know, my husband and I just made a decision that having a family was really important, and so we just decided to go on with our lives and hope that everything worked out. And I will say it is a different life than it was before children, but I have never regretted having kids in residency for a moment. They're just a joy.
Total inspiration. So thank you again so much for joining us on the surgery set and for your great service to the residency program. And we wish you all the best in your next endeavors. And we really mean that. And just a fantastic talk. I hope everybody gets a chance to go and see the full thing online. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kohler.
If you enjoy the surgery set or have suggestions on how we can make our program better, please provide us with your feedback. You can rate our podcast and leave your comments on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher. More comments makes it easier for people to find us, so please leave your rating and your comments. Or you can always just send us email at podcast@surgery.wisc.edu. Join us next time when we hear from Dr. Richard Davidson. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry here at UW, as well as the founder for the Center for Healthy Minds. He's talking about how he first began studying the science behind what it means to be happy, in addition to explaining some of the neuroscience behind this happiness phenomenon.
The reason that you study that now is because you met with the Dalai Lama.
I did, and I first met with him in 1992, and he challenged me in that meeting and encouraged me to use the same methods, the same neuroscientific tools, the same rigor that we were applying to the study of anxiety and depression and stress, and use those tools to study positive human qualities like kindness and compassion.
You will not want to miss it. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Veronica Watson and myself. It was recorded by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to grand rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health video library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher, and of course you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at @WiscSurgery or at @JEKohler. That's K-O-H-L-E-R. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and don't hesitate to let us know of any topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks. We hope you check back soon.